I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Now, why is it that we think romantic relationships can end, but we count on friendships as being forever? Why do we increasingly hear people say that their friends are actually family? And what is at the root of friendship that researchers now say improves cognitive function, inspires creative breakthroughs, and can ignite even social revolution? We explore the new science of friendship with longtime contributor Bruce Clements, one of my best friends, and Carlin Flora, author of Friendfluence, a look at the surprising ways friends make us who we are. Welcome to the show, both of you. Carlin, I wanted to start with you. How has society changed? How has life changed that affects friendship and makes it more important than ever?
Right. So a lot of changes have made it so that friends are fulfilling roles that used to be fulfilled by family members. So people are marrying later, if at all. Divorce rates are still fairly high, and more people are living alone than ever before. And also, there are more only children, which means that friends will be more important for this next generation of children.
So the only children are going to need playmates, so friends are going to be key for them. There are 14 million children with no in-house playmate, as you've explained it. And this business of marrying later in life is very interesting to me, because if you've got 40% of the households in big cities that are made up of just one person, you're saying that this creates a sense of the urban tribe, a unit of friends who take on, you know, are substitutes for family members.
Right. And the stereotype is that single people are lonely, when in fact people who live alone socialize more than people who are in a family structure in their home. So that's a myth. And not only are they more social, but yes, these friends are taking on roles that previously would be fulfilled by others. You know, think of healthcare. A lot of people are relying on a best friend to get them through an illness or to, you know, oversee things in a hospital situation. So that's just one example. So this is really a huge change in our society that is elevating the role of friendship, which of course has always been important.
Bruce Clements, I want to ask you about this, because you write novels for young adults. You're a mediator, divorce mediator, with the interests of children very much in mind as people are ending their relationships. Let's the two of you, starting with Bruce, talk about the importance of friendship for young people, because that's really where it starts.
Well, I think that one of the dynamics of being young is that very early on you're starting to stray. From the time you are an infant and trying to get to the other side of the coffee table, feeling your way around, you are moving away. And so in some sense, some fundamental way, I think you're looking for companions. You're looking for fellow seekers from very, very early on. And almost all of us find them, sometimes by accident. Sometimes our parents don't think they're the most suitable ones. But they are our comrades in exploration, which good parents are also, but which are absolutely necessary. And you know that instinctively. You have to have these comrades reaching out with you.
It almost appears, Carlin and Bruce, to me that kids must be hardwired somehow, because if you put a baby in the room and suddenly bring in another baby, they are fascinated with each other. And I think, is it because you're similar in age? But it's like a recognition. And I'm wondering if, I guess that refers to what you're talking about, Bruce. You're seeking fellow adventurers, fellow travelers at such a young age.
For their company, for their reassurance, for them to watch your back for you. Mm-hmm. And I think very, very early on, this pattern of give and take with someone who is your intimate and not a member of your family commences.
Yeah. Carlin, you say in the book, Friendfluence, that social skills developed as a child to make friends are the same social skills that you need for the rest of your life. So there's conflict resolution skills, empathy, moral reasoning, navigating gossip, shifting alliances. These are the skills as you're making friends that you learn.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So I think sometimes we separate social life and cognitive life when we think about children. But the way that their brains grow and the way they learn to think and reason and have these intellectual capacities is through interaction with other people. And as Bruce was saying, particularly with their peers, because they're built to fit into a peer group. You know, think about the evolutionary environment where if you didn't fit in with your peer group, if you were kicked out of the tribe, that was tantamount to death. So that's how important, you know, fitting in with one's peers is. And as far as these social skills and cognitive skills, you know, it's the same things that make us successful in life. A lot of us have had the rude awakening that even if you have great grades in school, you might not do well in an office environment where there are a lot of politics and social situations that you have to navigate.
What about the statistic that you point out about having just one friend connects to the atmosphere of bullying?
Right. So we've heard a lot about bullying lately, which is, it's just great that the awareness has been raised. But I think sometimes the friend aspect is left out of this. And just having one friend greatly reduces the chances that a child will be bullied. And if she is bullied, it greatly reduces the chances that she'll develop anxiety or depression as a result. So as much as we need to preach against bullying, we have to really teach kids how to make that one friend who will make a great difference in their development.
And moving it up in terms of age, again, as teenagers, what's the sense of identity that gets formed, you know, this kind of peer influence? What about identity as you have a friend?
So teenagers are trying to kind of try on different possible adult selves, and they do that through alliances with friends. And, you know, one part of this is having a friend who sort of sees you as you want to be rather than how you are. So if your friend kind of believes that you can become a certain person, that kind of lifts you up effortlessly. And peer pressure is often really positive. I think it has such a negative connotation of kids, you know, pressuring each other to drink and smoke. But really, peer pressure is the way that most kids learn to, you know, behave properly and strive for things and gain certain aspirations. So it's about trying on different selves and then finding that friend who really gets who you are and enables you to become your best self.
Bruce, is the young adult novel yet another way for young people to try on identities?
Well, yes, and of course, movies and television as well. But I think the novel, because it is leisurely, there is a, because you can go back over the certain paragraph, because you can read slowly or quickly, because it is private. It's just you and that piece of your life and that world. And it also, I think, often teaches you what a friend does and what a friend is, including tolerance, including accepting that other, loving that other person, even though they are not your ideal. In fact, even though they hurt you, working, you know, as a writer, working with a character who has to struggle not just, you know, with some outside force, but has to struggle with being misunderstood by people who are closest to them, and the encouragement that one gets by seeing this happen and seeing the friendship not disintegrate is, I think, very enlivening and is a teaching experience.
Carlin, there's a statistic that you use in the book that peer influence at the age of 13 has mm-hmm. been shown to be the most predictive of adult mm-hmm. outcomes. But what's interesting is that you say that that's true even when it's compared to two other ages, 15 and 17. There's something so critical about friendships and peer influence at age 13.
Right. I think it's because there's so many rapid changes going on that whoever, you know, is accompanying you on that journey, when the journey is you know, at its richest point, that's the person who's going to influence you the most. So I think that sort of explains the importance of age 13. And just the ongoing repercussions throughout life of being able to form solid friendships. And when Bruce was talking about, you know, learning to care for someone if they've hurt you and that kind of thing, it reminds me of how friendships are really templates for all of our future relationships. So it's about learning how to be in a romantic relationship later in your life, or learning how to have a you know, even a parenting relationship or a work relationship. So these are sort of the starter relationships that reverberate throughout life.
Friendship and Exploration with Bruce Clements, who writes young adult novels, and Carlin Flora, author of this book in paperback, Friendfluence. Let's get into the adult friendship. So we've been talking about young people. What is it about this idea that spouses, blood relatives are expected to be everything to us, but we have a more flexible attitude for friends, you know, that our friends can fill in these different roles?
Right. So I think it's a shame. We expect spouses to be the be-all and end-all and to fulfill every need and to, you know, bring out each of our qualities and interests. And it's just impossible. It's too high a standard. And I think it probably causes problems in marriages. Whereas if with friends, the beauty is that, you know, each one can kind of speak to a different side of us and fulfill a different need. And so that's why it's really important to keep maintaining a variety of friendships, even if you're really in the thick of a family life and raising children, et cetera. It's really important to reach out to friends who can fulfill these different emotional, spiritual, intellectual needs.
So you're talking about friends having different roles. So in one friendship, mm-hmm. you could be about being a confidant. If another one sees you as funny, or you see, so this is a comedian thing going on. Somebody else is a debate partner.
Right.
Somebody's there, you know, when you're especially blue and just gets what's going on in your life. So that's what you're talking about, all these roles. Here's what we're going to do. If you would both stay exactly where you are, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to get into the difference between romantic relationships that we think end, but count on friendships being forever. What's that about? And we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton, and we're talking about friendship on the show. Bruce Clements and Carlin Flora are my guests. So this really fits in. This is a way to say I love you and enjoy fantastic food and wine in a beautiful setting. Join me the week of Valentine's Day for my 5th annual heart-to-heart dinner dance. That's February 12th at the Society Room downtown Hartford, featuring a celebrated team of chefs working to make it a magical night for you, and wines from the gorgeous Frederick Wildman portfolio, music from Alex Nakamovsky, his vocalist and orchestra, special effects lighting from Audio Media Solutions, dress is festive. Tickets are $90 per person to benefit WNPR and the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. Plenty of parking at the site. Our team of talented chefs includes David Sellers of Max Fish, Jeffrey Lizotte of On 20, Brad Stabinski, Shamard Vineyards, Jason Sobosinski of Caseus, Jeffrey Crawford of Jordan Caterers, Stefan Drago of Bell Terrace, and Christopher Prosperi of Metro Beast Restaurant. The menu we just finished designing, it is mouthwatering. This event sells out. Seating is limited. Tickets at WNPR.org. Special special thanks to UConn Health Center's Pat and Jim Calhoun Cardiology Center and Fiddleheads. I cannot wait to see you there February 12th. Go to WNPR.org to be a part of my Food Schmooze signature event. Here's what we are doing on the show. We are talking about, we're exploring friendship. We talked about friendships and how that begins as a child. We know that humans have always looked to friends in our most early days, you know, as a reliance on others. We needed friends to survive. But it's interesting that we continue friendships. What is it in the story of our evolution that makes us continue to do that? So we have Bruce Clements and Carlin Flora, author of Friendfluence, talking about this. So we think that romantic relationships might come to an end, but we count on friendships as being forever. What's that all about?
I'm wondering how that, what the overlap is and what the difference is, in a way exactly what Faith is asking. What are the differences between being in love and having a friend, winning a friend and falling in love? There's got to be a lot of overlap, but where's the overlap and where are the differences?
Right. So it's hard to define friendship, and that's what gives it its strength. Some people actually do describe meeting a friend for the first time as akin to a romantic love at first sight meeting, where they just click instantly and they know this person is going to be an important part of their life. And, you know, there are a lot of friends, cross-gender friends, who have sex now. They're friends with benefits, as they say. So it is hard to form strict definitions. But I think friendship is sort of easier to navigate because you're not sort of trying to choose one partner and you're not putting everything on that one friend, as we talked about before. But also, friends do break up, and we might expect them to last forever, but friendship is not that stable. But in our culture, we don't really have a lot of support for people who are going through a friend breakup. You know, your boss isn't going to give you a day off because you have a friend breakup, whereas he might be sympathetic if you're going through a divorce. So I think the fact that we don't recognize how painful these friend breakups can be makes it harder to get over them.
You know, friendships change and time commitments change, and people have different ideas about how a friendship is going to go and can roll with the changes. And other people think it's got to be like this and it can't change. And so then the friction comes in and there can be a friend breakup, because you must then turn to the person and say, you know, I can't meet your demands right now. And if that means breaking up this friendship to you, then I guess that is, you know, it's not what I would do, but I guess that has to happen because I can't meet your demand.
Right. And I think a lot of times, more often than a dramatic breakup, we just tend to sort of back away from a friendship that's not working. And we just sort of dial down the frequency of seeing each other, and we just kind of fade away and go in different directions. But even that can be painful if one person doesn't want the distance. And I think, you know, it's important to be conscious of the benefits of long-term friendship, the enormous benefits on your health, et cetera. And if you're conscious of those, you might be more motivated to work out those difficulties rather than just avoiding the conflict and letting the friendship fade away.
Carlin, I feel very somehow suddenly distant from this conversation because at some level, I cannot believe in friendships that break up. I understand that your interests diverge, and so you see each other less and are in communication less. I understand that the demands on your energy are such sometimes that you simply cannot make the phone call or go across town. But for me, so much of the essence of friendship is being there even though the other has gone, or the other is straining, or the other even has done something that you feel was a betrayal. It's just hard for me to imagine ever giving up on one.
Right. Well, it sounds like you absolutely value long-term friendship and almost an Aristotelian ideal of being your best self in the way that you treat a friend despite the circumstances. So So that is a wonderful model. But I think people do have friend breakups. They definitely do, and it can be very painful. And sometimes the way to think about it philosophically is that the friendship was good for a certain time in one's life and contributed to that era, even if for whatever reason it does not continue.
Yeah, what you're saying sounds very, very sensible, and it makes me say, well, now am I the wrong kind of friend, or have I not felt friendships as intensely as I should, that I should be feel casual about? Well, unbelievable.
No, you should not. Here, this is what I'm saying to you. I'm thinking about you, Bruce. Carl and Bruce and I have known each other all my adult life. Mm-hmm. Bruce, I wouldn't change a thing about you. The way that you conduct friendships is so beautiful. And I think you're wise in your selecting, or the way you conduct it. I think you probably have had to have words or speak words with people about demands on your time or anything. It's just all okay, you know?
It sounds like Bruce is a very empathetic and conscientious friend, and maybe that just wards off these conflicts that other people deal with. And, you know, there is some gender-based research that indicates that some women might have more issues with intense friendships and the conflicts that come with that. So there might be a gender component here, but yeah, I suspect it's more about your superior treatment and attitude toward friendship than anything being wrong with you.
Thank you very much. But now, what is the gender difference that we're talking about here?
Right. So, you know, obviously these are generalizations, and I think things are changing with younger men as you know, they share equal roles with women at home and at work. But traditionally, men sort of share activities more with their friends, whereas women are happy talking and being just more intimate, sitting and having a cup of coffee together and sharing things. So men maybe will appreciate the time spent with a friend, but not open up emotionally with them as much, and also not pursue the friendship as much in terms of, if you move to another city, a man's not as likely to sort of keep up the friendship, whereas women are more conscientious about that.
You were saying that as we're talking about friendship in adulthood, that close friends can kind of fade away a bit. And then because people have marriages and children and there's a lot going on, careers, and then the kids go away and there's this empty nest. And you're saying that adults are then suddenly facing this hard question, which is, wow, how do I make new friends at my age?
Right. So I think this is a case where social science can be really motivating, because there's so much research on how friends are great for your health, even more so than spouses in some cases. So, and not just physical health, but mental and emotional health. So it's the kind of thing where you need to make it a priority and really be conscious if you're not having enough friends. But as far as going out there and making it, it is really hard as an older adult. You're not in a situation such as a classroom where you're just continually seeing the same people and you naturally, you know, form connections. So it takes more of an effort, and it might even require, you know, friend dating, where you're asking people to meet with you, and it might feel awkward, but it's a pursuit that's really worthwhile.
Well, any adult who's moved to a new community knows that experience of having to begin again and make friends just as you did when you were younger. It is a really daunting thing, and it's delicate and important. I wanted to ask you both about this. What if you have history with somebody? There are a lot of friendships that remain because of history. But people change, and so respect is paid to that history, but you say to yourself, would I make friends with this person now? Does this person have the kind of qualities that would, you know, or I'd be drawn to this person? And the answer is no. But you keep up the friendship because you both respect that you have a history together.
Well, maybe what you're doing is keeping up the friendship, but you really fundamentally are keeping up the connection. There are people with whom you exchange Christmas cards, you know, and you would not do that, partly because you feel it would be a betrayal of your own history to drop this person, partly because you do have some curiosity. But I agree with you, Faith. You sometimes find yourself saying, what was it that drew me to this person? Much as I treasured those hours, we are so unlike that beyond just acknowledging our past to one another, we really can't be useful to each other.
You know, Carlin, it's the imbalance, I think, that feels uncomfortable. Because at the same time, if you had a neighbor who seemed lonely for maybe death of a spouse, whatever, just lonely, you would spend some energy giving a little extra attention to that person. Whereas this long-term friend you've had over here, you're thinking, oh, I have to go through this. And we really don't have that much in common anymore, but we have this history. And so it's that my expectation of friendship is this. It has to be at a certain level to be called friend. And then on the other hand, I think, but really, I would be more generous to this kind of strange neighbor over here?
Well, I think it goes back to friendship not being easily defined. You know, some friends, the friendship does exist in the past and in shared memories and in growing through things together. You know, sometimes we act as a friend to someone who's in need, such as the neighbor that you're talking about. I think the important thing in terms of, really getting the most out of friendship is just making sure that you have in your life right now at least one really close friend with whom you click, with whom you can share your current sort of issues and thoughts and aspirations with right now in this moment. So you need that friend who's really accompanying you on wherever you are right now, as well as these other friendships that might just sort of, you know, vary in their shades and colors and degrees.
I have somehow a sense, and I don't want to make too much of the idea of suffering or enduring, but there are a few people I know who have suffered with me, and with whom I've suffered. I mean, not necessarily that I was with them all of the time or so much of the time, but that at a crucial time in their life, when they were feeling pain, I was around. and at such times as I was feeling pain and bereft, they were around. And just that proximity overcomes for me a huge number of possible differences in experience, in hopes, in connections. What, Carlin, is the connection between, if there is one in your view, between suffering and friendship?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it obviously brings people closer, and it gives you, as the friend of the person who's suffering, this opportunity to really comfort someone and make a big difference in their outlook and their life at a particular point. So I think it goes to the other side of friendship, which is the privilege of being able to give to others, that friends allow us to be generous, they allow us to share our wisdom, share our comfort, and this feels great. This gives us a sense of meaning and purpose in life. If no one's asking me for favors, if no one's crying on my shoulder, then, you know, I'm going to feel less needed and less valuable in life. So I think you can look at the suffering as an opportunity to be a great friend, which is just as important as having great friends.
Well, you're both, as we explore friendship with Bruce Clements and Carlin Flora, author of Friendfluence, you're both making me think about the Marine experience where people are in a unit together. And that is a bond that just never ends because they have shared laughs together, but they have suffered together. They have seen things together. And in some ways, this can happen in friendship. I think that's what you're saying, Bruce.
Yes, it is. And that suffering together in a military context is also has the element of he covered my back and I covered his, and he would have taken that bullet that was meant for me.
Well,
you cannot there's no way of measuring that knowledge. I was going to say that feeling, that knowledge that when my life was in danger, he put his life in danger in order to limit or diminish mine. And there's no substitute for that.
You know, one thing we need to do as we're going into, we're going to take a quick break, but we need to talk also about two things, the dark side of friendship and why there aren't more ceremonies to celebrate friendship. And that's something that you raise in your book, Carlin, and I thought that was interesting. I have a story for you because I once did have a ceremony to celebrate a friendship. It was wonderful. I'll never forget it all these years later.
Great.
So Bruce Clements and Carlin Flores, stay where you are, please, and we'll continue our exploration of friendship on the dark side and on the light side. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We're exploring friendship with Bruce Clements and Carlin Flora, author of Friendfluence in paperback. Let's, before we get to celebrating friendships, the dark side of friendship. There's been a lot written in the past couple of years. We're obsessed with obesity, about how friends can make you fat. I remember that headline, that friends do have an influence on good things, but also on bad things. The wrong friends can change your habits, your values, and your attitudes, your personality, for the worse.
Because we're built to fit into a group, we just sort of unconsciously adopt the norms and values of the groups in which we belong, to which we belong. So, yeah, this amazing network research by James Fowler and Nicholas Christakis has shown that if a friend gains weight, you're more likely to gain weight. If your friend drinks more, you're more likely to drink more. Friends who smoke more have friends who smoke more, and on and on. And then values are a little bit harder to measure, but you can think of it in terms of, you know, friends who spend a lot of money on clothes. You know, if you get in with a group like that, you'll start spending more money on clothes and valuing that more. So it doesn't mean that you should dump your friends if they have bad habits. It means that you should be more aware of how they're influencing you and also how you can turn that around and, you know, be a good influence on them. If you drink less, then the converse is true, that your friends will start drinking less over time.
And also, for the better, you know, if your friend says, I'm going to get healthy, you know, I'm going to start exercising, then your tendency is to say, okay, I'm going to join you. And you end up being a support for each other. If you see a friend being particularly loyal or having a value, a moral value that is so respectable. I've certainly had that experience where I've watched friends do something and I think, what integrity. I want to be more like that. It really has had an influence on me.
I have a friend from the Children's Law Center who is part of a team and in a gymnastics setting, and or I guess a bodybuilding setting, and she has become extraordinarily close to these people. She's also lost a heck of a lot of weight, but that's almost incidental. And they have rituals, and they encourage each other and challenge each other, and that circle of people is extraordinarily close.
That's such a great example, and I think it goes to, you know, one of my pet issues, which is willpower. We put so much pressure on people to cultivate willpower by themselves, and really, you know, I think it should be about other help rather than self-help, that if you just band together with people, as Bruce is describing, then that's much more motivating, and the friendship is the motivator versus, you know, beating yourself up and trying to force yourself to do things you don't want to do.
What's the link between friendship and happiness?
It's a very strong predictor of happiness. The reason, in general, strong social relationships is the biggest predictor of happiness, bigger than money, success, anything else. And friendship in particular makes us happy because it makes us feel that we matter. It goes back to, you know, feeling that, that you matter in someone's life, and that really lends a lot of meaning.
And this mattering, you know, I find measurable and in some ways very primitive. It makes a difference whether the other person knows that you took a piece of your life and gave it to them. And that, you know, that includes taking that 45-minute piece of your life, which involved writing a letter or making a phone call. I've come to feel in the last years that that simple time, you know, as I grow older and my time on Earth runs out, that investment is seen and is enlivening to whoever you give it to, and enlivens you when someone has just taken the time. I'm writing now about a 16-year-old girl who was in the hospital at St. Luke's in New York, near St. John the Divine, and her friend came every Wednesday and every Saturday, and on Wednesday ate her food and substituted a roast beef sandwich and fries. You know, she came in, ate hospital food, and did that for her. And it's something that you do not forget.
Mm. I was just reading from your book, Carlin, the Virginia Woolf quote. Virginia Woolf said, "Some people go to priests, others to poetry, I to my friends." So let's talk about this. There aren't many rituals, or maybe any, for celebrating friendships. We have every other kind of ritual. I've even heard of divorce parties. So, in fact, I participated in one. So here's the deal. When I was in high school, I had these three friends, Tom, Dee, and Bonnie. And it was a great, great friendship. And Tom, being the most mushy of us all, said, "We need to have a ceremony to cement our friendship as we all go off to college." And, you know, so we did this whole thing by this, you know, waterfall, and it was really a very dramatic. I think that the Bonnie probably was looking at us like we were crazy. But, you know, I will never forget it. It was, I thought, well, why didn't I ever do that again in my life? You know, just throw a party or a dinner for someone just to celebrate that our friendship.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll hear couples who will go out to dinner after they've dated for 6 months, and then you'll see friends who have been friends for 40 years who have never, you know, raised a glass to their friendship. So I think it's just one of those things where if we have it in our minds that this would be a fun and meaningful thing to celebrate, it'll motivate us to also appreciate our long-term friendships more and cultivate them more and sort of see the long term. So, I encourage everyone to, even if you don't know the exact date you met, to call up that friend that you've had for 5 years or 10 years or 30 years and go celebrate.
And even when they're not there, my best guy friend and I would meet occasionally, more than occasionally, and we always had a martini. And he would say, "Bombay, but not Sapphire." You know, that became a Sprichwort, a part of a ceremony for us. And I never had a martini, Bombay, but not Sapphire, without him, because that ceremony, you know, casual as it was and unobtrusive as it was, nobody else would have sitting around would have known that, has that sacred, evocative, you know, liturgical almost quality for me.
Huh, and I suppose it could have been anything, huh, Bruce? I
mean, absolutely, it could have been
hot chocolate,
anything.
Yeah. Cookies, you know.
And when I was in high school, talking about ceremonies of friendship, I was summoned one day to the projection booth in the auditorium, and I went to the projection booth at the suggested or demanded time. And there was a circle of friends who made me an honorary Italian. I had to kneel and touched me with a box of spaghetti on both shoulders, by the way. And and I felt, yeah, this was sacred.
Yeah. This should be a badge. I mean, it's something tangible. We have to see. I mean, really, that's terrific. I can think of about 18 cultures I'd like to be inducted into, as a matter of fact. Well, I tell you, I don't know about anybody else, but I certainly feel as we're starting the new year that I need to recommit to tending my friendships. I do a lot of commuting, and but you have made me, you've opened my eyes, the two of you, to the value of this, the importance of this, and managing it is another story, but wow, I see how important this is.
Yeah, right. What else is there? I mean, in some sense, what else is there except the company of those who rejoice with us when we're rejoicing and weep with us when we weep, and without them, we're just so alone.
Carlin, you made the point that friends are the focal point of school for teenagers. I mean, essentially, that's why I went, and it was true for me in college, too. It was much more important than anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you say, you know, young people aren't taught about friendship. Mm-hmm. There's no class in how vital this is going to be for your entire life. Mm-hmm. And that has never struck me before.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there's a kind of a different levels of content that could apply there. One is basic social skills. For some kids, it's very easy to just make friends, to fit into, you know, an ongoing interaction, and to be assertive but not too aggressive, and these kinds of things. For other kids, it's like a mystery, you know, and there are a lot of kids now on the autism spectrum who really struggle with reading social cues. So mm-hmm. all the more reason we need to teach kids that social skills are something that they can learn if they don't have them naturally. And then the second part would be, yeah, just sort of planting the seeds that your friends are really going to shape you for the rest of your life. And you kind of do become who you hang out with. And so if a kid has a certain aspiration or wants to be a certain kind of person, it's important for them to cultivate friendships with people who have those same values and aspirations. And then they will be sort of lifted up to that level. So to think that we're just these individuals who act independently and get where we want to go independently, that's just a total fallacy. If you look around, you know, people are have similar outcomes in life to their friends.
Carlin, what about some of us are just better at it than others, and some of us are more, tending than others. And I wonder if you'd comment on the sense of obligation someone might feel to continue a relationship even though the other side has dropped it, or to keep a circle of people going even when the others in that circle are because of life circumstances and distractions no longer interested. Are there tenders who take that as part of their life vocation?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, yeah, there's going to be a range of approaches to friendship, of course, but I think, and there are some ethical obligations if someone's lonely or really in need, you know, maybe you need to be a friend with them even if you're moving apart in other ways. But I think at the same time, you do have to always be making sure that you're strengthening and making friends with people who will help you get where you want to go. So it's kind of balancing both of those ideas. And also, as far as individual differences, you know, some introverts don't need a lot of friends. They don't need a lot of social stimulation, and they're fine with just a few close friends, whereas extroverts are always going to need a wider variety of social interaction.
You were saying that you think that you can feel put out if a friend asks you lots of favors, because friends do. And then the reverse happens, that you're hurt, you're rejected if you hear that friend is asking somebody else for a lot of favors.
Right, right. So it's one of these sort of conundrums, or maybe paradoxes, where yeah, we might slightly feel annoyed, but then when we realize that we're no longer number one with someone, you know, we feel demoted and left out. So it's just a good reminder that you know, sometimes our friends will annoy us, and sometimes they'll bore us, and sometimes they'll irritate us, but it's just such a huge, what a small price to pay for all their benefits.
I was intrigued with this. Is it Samin Vazir? The psychologist who runs the Personality and Self-Knowledge Lab at Washington University. Friends are better at describing our behavioral traits than we are.
So right. So this was a fun line of research. And one thing she concluded was that friends are more accurate guessers of our IQs than we are. And incidentally, we pick a lower number than our friends do, and our friends are right. So we're smarter than we think we are. But I thought that was really interesting, that friends could assess our intelligence better than we can. They could also assess whether we're charming, some other characteristics, funny, et cetera. So it's when it just points to the fact that friends know you better than you know yourself. And so if you do want to change, or you want insight into a behavioral pattern that you have, it's really great to get honest feedback from your friends, even if it's a little bit difficult to hear sometimes. Those are the people who can really point out your patterns.
This also was interesting. I think you wrote this for the Huffington Post, this idea about the Dutch sociologist Molenhorst. And I think he tracked about 1,000 people of all kinds, all ages, and found that on average, this is so amazing, Bruce, we lose half of our close network of friends, our network members, every 7 years.
Right. So that is some evidence for that turnover that we were talking about before, a lack of stability, that, you know, if you look at the people you call most frequently right now, 50% of those people will not be on your most called list in 7 years. And some of this is just sort of natural. As we move through different phases in life, we need, you know, to become close to people who are sharing those phases. You know, we move geographically, et cetera. So some of it just sort of makes sense as we grow and develop, and some of it maybe is a shame and can be prevented if we, again, value long-term friendship.
There are two things that I think of. One is the function, the obligation. I guess I'm really the obligation that I feel to be there with people for whom I've been there before is pretty high. And then the other thing I'm thinking of is that there may be people, I would propose, there are people for whom connections of all sorts, marriage, friendship, they find perfectly comfortable even though it's 70% their effort and 30% the other effort. That is just not a math that interests them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. There are people who just make plans. They are the ones who are locking things down on the calendar, remembering, you know, people's special events. And there are people whose minds just don't work that way, whether, you know, for moral reasons or just simple organizational habits. So that is true. There are some people who are just good friend maintainers, and other people who benefit from that.
Yeah. Our youngest daughter is one of those, 75%ers and non-counters of investment. And she is a lot happier for it.
Yeah, I think we're all sitting here thinking, oh, I want to be that person. I just want to say thank you both. And by the way, if you were wondering, because your book, Carl and Flora, is called Friendfluence. And that is defined as the powerful and often unappreciated role that friends, past and present, play in determining our sense of self and the direction of our lives. Bruce Clements, thank you as always.
Thank you, my friend.
My dear friend.
Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome, and thank you. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.